This is the E of Real Estate. My name is René Stevens and I'm your host. My guest today is David Fadissi, a spiritual adventurer and anthropologist who went on a search for superhuman abilities but found also himself. In short, a spiritual Indiana Jones who mapped the superhuman journey for us all. David Fadissi has dedicated his life to seeking to achieve his full potential, the peak of Maslow's hierarchy. He applied mind training, compared wisdom traditions from around the globe, methods of rigorous training discipline, and altered states of consciousness during his adventurous hero's journey. As a wandering anthropologist, he went on a journey across the world and around the world for some 30 plus years, I understood, to find life's purpose, but also some extra people with extraordinary abilities. And from his ongoing quest to discover and understand the full potential of what it means to be human, David Fadissi has distilled practices and adapted them to modern life. He developed a blueprint with a new algorithm of practices, which he teaches as a life coach. So I hope we can go a little bit into that later on. A spiritual Indiana Jones, as I said, who by his hero's journey through known and unknown territories of matter and mind became an extra-ordinary human himself. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much, René.
In this podcast, I would like to explore your thoughts, what it means to be a human being, and how the outer environment affects us, especially in higher educational work environments, where this podcast is all about. Mm-hmm. And normally I start from the outer environment towards the inner environment of humans. This time I would like to start the other way around and start with the inner environment. Outer environment I describe as consisting of three parts: physical, digital, and social. Although it's not so much about the separate parts as well about the integrated whole, the ecosystem of bricks, bytes, and behavior. An inner environment of humans you could approach by the continuum of matter to spirit, so the body, mind, heart, and spirit complex. And also there is not about the parts, but about the integrated whole. In your documentary, Book of Knowledge, you start with some quite interesting questions. Who am I? Where am I within myself? And where am I within the boundaries of this reality? So after a search of about three decades, what have you discovered? Who is David Fadissi truly? And what is a human being in general truly? Can you elaborate on that, please?
Those are big questions, I think. Each one has to find his or her own answer to that.
Uh-huh.
I don't think that anyone can, neither should, give this answer for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Let's try a question that is a bit less of a wide scope, because questions like these are they're too large, and too general to encompass. Let's try to focus in on something, more up to the point.
What is it that
you are really asking me here?
Yeah, actually, I'm asking you if you could share some of your main findings. That people who are listening to this say, well, he took 30 of years of his life. Although I know there is no shortcut, but maybe there is something they can learn from your discoveries about themselves.
Mm-hmm. there are a lot of cliches, and the cliches are cliches for a reason, because they are archetypal. So if I am to tell you that after a 30 plus year journey, the answer is love, is a cliche, but it's also true. I always say that when love is the answer, there is no more question. As long as something else is the answer, there are still a lot of questions. And as a human being, when you understand experientially that love is the answer, then all other questions disappear. There are no questions. And is all extremely simple. Now, simple is not easy. Simple, simplicity is very complex, but it is simple. So if you really want the quintessence of it, that is it.
Mm-hmm.
The answer is love. And when that is the answer, there are no other questions.
Well,
the mind ceases to run, to search, to look, to ask, the restlessness, the wandering of the mind, the quest is ended in peace, in fulfillment, in joy, in love. And that is the cliche. I know that is a cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason, because it is an archetypal and perennial truth. So let me start here, because that is what is true to me at the end of this journey. Now, how do you bring love about? That is the real question. And I believe, as an educator, that there is a great gap in the educational system. And there are several gaps in the educational system, not only one. But the fact that we learn historical days of when this emperor conquered, I don't know, this or that country, and we learn many other anecdotes or partial facts about, I don't know, history or religion or geography or whatever that is, politics. But we are not given, since early age, a real education of learning how to love. We learn how to write, we learn how to sing, we learn mathematics, but nobody really thought that the most important matter to learn is how to love. Because how to love determines everything in our life, from our identity, our personality, our relationship with ourselves, with our environment, with society, with our peers, okay, with the, you know, divine, whichever way you formulate it to be. It determines everything. It's the highest pinnacle of humanity, of a human being. If we speak in you know, evolutionary term, you mentioned, you know, Maslow pyramid. I mean, you know that when Maslow devised the pyramid, he put sort of realization on the top of the pyramid, and then he went back after looking at more Asian spiritual traditions, and he discovered that actually there is one more step after self-realization, is self-transcendence. Now, what does allow for that transcendence is love. Because you spend the first half of your life crafting this perfect self, okay, fulfilling all the base of the pyramids, and then you have crafted this beautiful self. And then you realize that it is not enough. You have to craft it, build it, and then you have to let it go. You have to go beyond it. And so all the second part of life should be or is consciously or unconsciously, willingly or unwillingly, a journey in transcending that very self that you have built for you know, a good part of your life. And that transcendence comes about not as a mental exercise, not as some gimmick of crossing your legs or, I don't know, visualizing chakras or praying to images of you know, dead people on the cross or however else you represent the God to be. But it comes about through and by our ability to love, which is something that invests every aspect of a person, of an individual, from the psychology of a person to the transpersonal realities of the person. So that, I believe, that is the most important topic. And there is only really one topic that is worth discussing. And it is that. It is love. Can we love? What is it that is keeping us from love? What walls have we built around it? As Rumi, the Sufi, you know, poet used to say, you know, your only work is to destroy the walls that keep you from this love. Right. And I believe that is right on point. Anything else is a futile conversation because it's a limit. Love is effervescent, is unlimited. The more you use it, the more you practice it, the more it grows. Is an infinitely renewable energy, the only infinitely renewable energy. All other energy forms, physical or metaphysical, they tend to be exhausted. Okay. Love is unique because of this very nature. It exponentially grows the more is practiced, the more is lived, the more is felt. So an education in learning how to love, in loving, in generating this emotion, because love is not some complicated intellectual philosophical discussion. Love is an emotion that you feel in your heart. Okay, and it needs effervescence, it then spread everywhere and puts wings on your feet and makes you feel alive. Okay. So how do we cultivate that in our life? That is the question. And I came to, you know, create a, you know, to a certain extent, a talk and a whole concept. I'm actually even thinking to write, you know, about it. I call it the 15-minute solution. And the 15-minute solution is, can you practice and be in love 15 minutes every day? And if you can do that, well, not only, of course, your life, you know, will dramatically improve and radically change and transform, but you will be happy. Mm-hmm. You know, you will automatically be in harmony between your inner environment, your outer environment. There will be coexistence and synergy between the two aspects, you know, and you don't need to be religious, you don't need to be spiritual, you don't need to be Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, esoteric, or whatever. Mm-hmm. You just need to love. It's just beyond definition. And it's an emotion that is brought about by simple things. You can use everything to elicit that. Then can you make it an object of meditation, in the sense, in the etymology of the word meditation, that is medio stare, mediaistemi, to be placed in the middle. That's the original word of meditation. People use this word nowadays for, you know, many things, but it is very simple etymological roots. It simply means to put something in the center of your cognitive ability. Okay, so can you make a meditation love? Can you put love at the center of all of your senses, of all of your perception, of your mind attention? That's then the second stage in the 15-minute solution. First, you learn how to generate. Okay, you rediscover how to generate. And then you learn to sustain. Okay, and if you can do it 4 or 5 times a day, 2-3 minutes each time, just the time of an average song. Okay, when you put music, the average song that you listen is about 3 minutes. Okay, so just listening 3 songs a day, 3 to 4 songs a day, will already bring about a profound transformation. That is the answer that I can give you after 30 odd years, okay? Which I believe erase all other questions when it becomes an experiential reality, not an intellectual debate.
Yeah, yeah. I follow you completely. I agree, because it has to be simple after so long time when you really find a truth. And sometimes I use the example when about people being in love. I never heard about somebody who is in love who went to a doctor and please do a check. Am I really in love? Because you just know when it is real. And I have the impression that you are also referring to that state that you just know. So, yeah, there are no questions.
There are no questions. It's simple. It's a primal emotion. It's the primal emotion that the child experiences toward these caretakers. Yeah. When it's simple that a dog experiences when you look at you or when you look at your child or. It's simple. It's not a very complicated, esoteric thing. Yeah. We all know it. We all know it.
Yeah. Right. Another thing that probably you can also shine a light on is there's a coming saying that people have to follow their dreams. But there are also many people who say, I have a quest to awaken from the dream, whatever that is. To me, there seems to be a conflict. So follow your dream, be in a dream state, and awaken from the dream, what some called as reality, the matrix, or give it a name. Can you elaborate about this dilemma a little bit?
Well, we need to put some context because there is, you know, an expression used in Buddhism about this in the context of the idea of awakening, that our mind is constantly chasing after dreams of a future and, you know, an intention, a fantasy possibility, a desire, okay, and this process sort of never ends. And so in Buddhism, as in other sort of mostly Asian traditions, this is seen as a futile exercise because it is tantamount to follows images, literally scenarios, mirage, okay, that are the projection of an unfulfilled mind. That's what I say, a mind that still doesn't know that love is the answer. And so has a lot of questions, a lot of wishes, a lot of fantasies, and I want this, and I this, and this. It's, those are all symptoms that you still don't know what love is. That love is still not the answer for you. And so you're still under the spell that there is something else out there. Now, when this is put into the context of specifically a Buddhist or a, you know, Samkhya philosophy, so fundamentally, you know, Vedanta or Advaita Vedanta, or, you know, similar sort of path, that one becomes very specific and very far from people's immediate realities, because awakening in the context described by the Buddha or by these great spiritual champions, it is something that it's just very far, okay, from anyone that is living a life, you know, here in the world, okay? So I wouldn't necessarily quote it as something relevant, because even the very idea of awakening, it is something that would need to be explained on a very intellectual level, and it doesn't really mean anything. It's not even meaningful nor really attractive for someone that lives a normal life, okay? That is not a monk or an ascetic up in the mountains or a yogi, right? So I wouldn't worry too much about the idea of awakening, if not in the context that you need to wake up to the fact that the only thing that really matters is love. Everything else is a dream. So when you can awake to this reality, and again, love is the answer, automatically all these questions, all this speculation, wanting this, that, they just vanish. They just disappear. Even the question of the immortality of the soul and the paradise or hell, even these disappear. Okay. So I bring it back to, you know, to the core topic.
Mm-hmm. And I switch to another topic. In quantum mechanics, instruments, experiments shows that thoughts and emotions can affect the material world. And they say everything is energy, and energy is shaping matter. Also, Albert Einstein mentioned that in his famous quote, E equals mc squared, where E is energy on one side and M is the mass or the matter on the other side. Mm. So how does the outer environment affect us as humans? And how do we affect the outer environment? So when there is a emotion of love, that will does that affect the outer environment and vice versa? And those people you interviewed or you lived with and practiced with all these many years, with their so-called superhuman abilities, they have an effect, I think, on the environment they live in. And again, environment is not just the physical, it can also be other people.
The Romans, they had an expression, mens sana in corpore sano, that means a healthy mind in an healthy body. So how mental states influence the environment of in the immediate of the body first, and vice versa, of course, is a well-established fact, from psychosomatic to the placebo effect. I don't know very much about, you know, quantum mechanics, so I rather don't quote what I don't know exactly, but for sure, the recognition that there is an entanglement in the web of life, and so going back to the Buddha, everything is interconnected, okay? Everything is dependently originated. So everything depends and is influenced by everything else, right? And everything else is influenced by everything else. So we live in this very complex web of relationships, okay? This is for sure is a fact. And and how it goes from influencing the psychological influencing the physical influencing the psychological. This again, I think that it's a given fact. So we are constantly influencing our environment. If we speak of the immediate physical environment that is influenced by our mental states, and vice versa, how our physical states influence our mental environment. So logically, if you feel good in the body, if you have slept well, if you eat the right food for you, you know, generally you will be in a fairly good mental state, okay, as a baseline, okay? If you do sport and your body is healthy, you know, it will reflect and it will influence the environment of your mind. So there is a two-way connection between the so-called body-mind continuum, okay? That literally goes two ways, mm-hmm. body into mind, mind into body, and they influence these two environments are actually one environment, okay? With a degree of different, let's say, solidity, to a degree. And if we expand this one to a reflection of how then the interaction between the body-mind environments, to use the word that you prefer, influence or is connected with outer environment, well, in the very same way. I mean, the famous example that the very same street and houses and trees and city that you walk through every day, depending on your mood, your mental state, some day can be depressive and ugly, and some day can be, you know, joyous, hopeful, and beautiful. Okay, so how our internal states, you know, influence our perception of external reality, also this is fairly easily measured or at least experienced. Maybe it's not so easy to measure, but it definitely can be experienced. And vice versa, you know, when you are in a beautiful environment that is conducive to elevated thoughts or moods, it influences your mental state and your body feels, you know, you are in nature, you think, you know, the for example, in Japan, they have this culture, this tradition of going into the woods, and sort of is considered sort of an health practice, because being immersed in nature immediately reflects on your state of anxiety or stress, and it even influences your cortisol level or anything. So the continuation, this continuum that exists between mind, body, and environment, I think it is something that empirically and experientially, if you just start to think about it, you will just recognize as a fact, as a matter of fact. And they go both ways, right? Mm-hmm. Your internal state can turn an ugly place into a beautiful place. If you are in love, they say that no place is ugly, right? Mm-hmm. When you go to India, they always tell you that, you know, if you see, you know, whatever, the dirtiness or degrade around, it's just because your mind is not pure enough. You know, so to a pure mind, to an elevated mind, a mind that is in love and joy, nowhere is ugly. Everything becomes beautiful, okay? And vice versa, it is also true, you know, that the environment has immediate effect on the mind. Well, if you sit into an hospital for 5 minutes, you know, generally you feel that, you know, there is something just unpleasant there, you know, right? Whereas if you are in a beautiful chateau somewhere in France or on the you know, whatever is it, right? Or on the Sea of Sardinia, yeah. Right? That colors that everything around influence automatically your mood. So the interconnectedness between either inner and outer environments is a matter of fact, is a reality. Now, I think that the question here is, although it's empirically known when it's observed and reflected upon, many people just don't maybe spend enough time thinking of the profound implication of this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I think it's more a matter of making people aware of what's there all the time. Mm-hmm. We live in a miracle. We live in this, you know, complex web of reciprocity and interconnection and dependent origination, meaning that every state depends on other existing state of the perceptorium, that is from the physical to the psychological, right? So we live in this just mirror, and it just needs to be pondered to be recognized as a miracle. Okay. Mm-hmm. And just doing that can give a sense of awe, of marvel, of elation, of perfection, of sort of the Pythagorical or Platonic, you know, marvel at the wonder of the architecture of reality. Okay.
Yeah.
And that is enough to elevate the human spirit, the human mind to a new level, to contemplate what Plato called the highest good, which is beauty.
Yes.
Okay. Not necessarily as aesthetical beauty, but the beauty that a mathematician can see in the beautiful mathematics of reality, or the beauty that a physicist can see in the elegance of the laws of physics, right? And so what Plato called the highest good, it is something that we all can have access to if we simply open our eyes to observe the marvel, the beauty, the complexity that we are constantly immersed in, and how all the state, inner and outer and inner, psychological and physical, environmental and social, they all connect. They are always all connected when we see it. We just sometimes we are disconnected and we don't see it.
Yes.
We fail, okay, to recognize what is always there, right? But when we open our eyes and we see what we are immersed on, this magnificent web of life, okay, we are elevated because we see the beauty, the good that Plato described, right? And in that moment, we're also definitely brought into a state of love, because it is automatic. It's one of the way how to get into the state of love is just by the simple recognition of what, you know, religious people call the intelligent design, you know, that sense of gratitude, of gratefulness that this incredible universe exists around us, right? So this whole thing with these superhuman abilities, it has no space in a human life.
Yeah.
Because you just need to have the instrument to see what is around you, and you don't need some special superpowers to see what is around you.
Yeah.
Okay, to recognize what is there. You don't need superpowers to be in love. You don't need superpowers to be a Buddha. You don't need superpowers to be a saint. You don't need superpowers to be a good human being. You don't need superpower to recognize the intricacy, the complexity, and the wonder of life. You just need eyes to see it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you know, what you can learn, for sure, that's what I say, I think it's a big gap in our education, is to have good instruments, good tools to help you to establish yourself in a state of recognition, of seeing and knowing,
okay, yes.
and being present to it and being part of it rather than disconnected from it, right?
That brings me to another question, David. You visited the Borobudur temple in Indonesia. Could you say that that structure and also other sacred structures has an effect on consciousness of humans? So when you are in that area, it will affect your state of being. It brings you in a state of general love. Like what I understood is that with mandalas, they emit a certain energy, and a yantra is a 3D mandala. So the temple could be seen as a 3D energy machine that affects you when you are there. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Well, again, I don't think that you need to resort to, esoteric theories. That's what I say. It's like you go for a walk in the forest. The external environment influences you. So there is a reciprocity between the outer and the inner. You go into the Louvre Museum and you stand in front of some of these paintings. So you enter in any beautiful, awe-inspiring space, and it has an influence on your mental states, for sure. Do temples and churches have some arcane power to influence you more than a beautiful forest? No. I don't believe so. It's not my experience. There are thousands of people, of tourists, that visits the Pyramid of Egypt or Borobudur or Louvre or, you name any other so-called power esoteric spots. Thousands and thousands of people every day. Are their mind influenced? Maybe there's 0.1%. But 99.99% of the people, no, they would just go take photos, make selfies, and walk out, and nothing. Okay. So it's a projective fantasy to believe that, oh, this place now is special. I have the sacred mandala, my energy, the pyramid, Borobudur. It's a fantasy. Okay. You walk in a forest and you open yourself to the complexity and the beauty of the perfect asymmetry of nature. It can bring you into, as much as an aligned and expanded state as if you are a devoted, Christian or a devoted Hindu or a devoted I don't know who that goes into a place to which you assign this a special value. And then of course the place will have an influence. It's like people go, oh, I go to the Pyramid of Borobudur, I feel something special. No, they don't. But they think that they do, because they have read somewhere that if they go there is some fancy theory that the torus, the energy, they have read it somewhere and they have convinced themselves of that. So when they go to that place, they will experience something, right? But 99% of the people, if you don't first cue their mind into believing that you should experience something there, and you just make a placebo random experiment, you will not have any greater result than again of going somewhere else, okay, into a museum or I don't know, whatever, right? So I am a very, very, very skeptical person of all these esoteric, whatever theories, personally.
So I hear you saying that, let me say it in a different way. Suppose you compare the outer environment with aiding wheels on a children's bicycle to help those children to balance. Is there a way that you can use the built environment to as a kind of tuning fork to bring people in a certain state? And love is the answer, so in a state of love. Just like a natural forest or nature in general can bring you to tears. I have to experience myself when I was in Altai Mountains in Siberia. I started crying all of a sudden Well, yeah, no, we,
you know, when you go to the, you know, to the mountains and you watch a beautiful sunrise or a sunset, and sometimes just that bring about an emotion that you can't explain, and that is it. You don't need anything very complicated out of it, and you definitely don't need Borobudur or I don't know who or which pyramid to bring you to that state. I mean, if you are a religious inclined person, of course, if you enter in some beautiful European church, you will feel a sense of awe. And I don't deny that architecture, the creation of space does create specific vectors of forces, of electromagnetic fields. I don't deny that. Mm-hmm. It's a fact. Okay, that is a scientific fact. But if that would be enough to change the heart of man, okay, mm-hmm. humanity would have already been changed by a long, long, long time. All right, clearly so, right? So we cannot rely on some architectural gimmick to bring about any real change in human, you know, mind, consciousness, or something. But for sure, there is a response that our mind responds to in relation to the environment that is placed in. And so certain environment, they bring about, for sure, certain either emotional states or at least a change in mental states, you know, for sure. This is a fact. Mm-hmm. But those are like, you know, nanomolar changes. They are like tiny, tiny little changes that are not really observable or measurable, and you cannot really rely on them to bring about a change of spirit or a change of mind into a human being.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
That is just my point, you know.
Yeah, exactly. That is also my understanding after many years of working in this field, that in the end, it's all about human beings and not about these structures. And you can feel very depressive, but a most beautiful building will not change that much.
Exactly.
And the other way around, when you are happy, yeah, then and you see through the dirt in India, yeah, yeah, indeed. So when we are coming back to human beings, as you said already in the beginning, it's all about love. You have another intriguing quote on your website. True luxury is not material. The power to finding and creating one's happiness is the real luxury of life.
Sorry, Ren, can you repeat, please?
True luxury is not material. The power to finding and creating one's happiness is the real luxury of life. That's what one of your quotes on your website. And for the last 3 years, we experiencing a very turbulent and chaotic time frame in the world. And can you share maybe some insights of how people can cope with that? Can cope with their state, to cope with that really turbulent state. So by definition, it is turbulent because it's changing all the time, life and the world. But this now seems to be in between two phases, the chaos in between two phases to me. What is your take on this?
Well, you know, there is just more access to information, and information manipulate the state of the masses. So before there was just less access to information, and you know, people just, you know, didn't know. They were living their life with their natural degree of anxiety from life itself, from not knowing what is happening, because nobody knows. what's going to be tomorrow. So as human beings, you live in a constant state of anxiety of not knowing, and you compensate this by trying to establish control on your inner and outer environment as a coping mechanism. So this is sort of, you know, and I don't want to sound, you know, bleak or negative. Again, sort of, you know, matter of fact, sort of is the condition, you know, of our mind, of our life. And I think that simply the manipulation of information through the media that is cueing people to feel more or develop a polarized opinion about something is just fueling this state of anxieties, okay, that then become unmanageable. Okay. And so when the balance is, let's say, broken, so we live in a state of anxiety because we are mortal beings, and we compensate this by searching and establishing mechanisms of controls, inner and outer. That's nature, okay? But when this balance is off, so when the degree of perceived anxiety is greater than your ability to cope with it, so that means to establish control on the inner and outer environment, then you go into depression. Because suddenly your coping mechanism, that is your immune system, psychological immune system, is just can't deal with it anymore, right? But if you ask me, are we in some, you know, different condition that we were 1,000 years ago, or 500 years ago, or 10,000 years ago? No, it's all the same. Mm-hmm. But the degree of manipulated cueing of emotion and information that are crafted to generate very precise, polarized responses in the masses, this is new. But, you know, people nowadays are, just to say, aware of, let's say, a virus, okay? Or nowadays, the next fad, it's, you know, the war. And just simply, you are aware of it because they told you so. And they told you who you should support and who you should not. You have been told to do that. But I can, you know, assure you that if every person would take the time to dig into the number of other wars that are happening and were happening in the world in the past 10, 20, 30, 50 years, 5 years, 3 years before this very last one, you would be appalled. There are as many war as you don't want to know there are. And they don't tell you that there are. And so you are okay with it. But then they tell you that there is this war and this one matter. The other ones don't matter.
Yes.
And so you are polarized to generating an opinion, a feeling, and an emotion specifically toward this one, not for the other 5, 10, 15 wars that are happening in the same time in parallel with sometimes much greater casualties and more complicated ethical and moral issues around, right? And the same thing goes for, you know, viruses and diseases and everything. I mean, the history of humanity is an history of war, famine, and diseases, okay? There is at no time in history, somewhere in the world, there was always at least 2, 3, 5, 10, 100 wars happening at all times.
Yes.
At all times in human history, somewhere in the world, there was an epidemic and somebody was dying. So there are not more wars now than there were before. Okay. But there is now a very sophisticated information or manipulation of information mechanism that affects people's minds. Mm-hmm. So how do we balance that? Well, sovereignty. You know, again, you go back to understanding and the outer environment does influence you internally. Mm-hmm. And so you need to create strategies so that you can become sovereign of your mental and physical states, so to be able to withstand an unnatural pressure from the outer environment, okay, until a certain, you know, osmosis or balance is reestablished. Okay. And that can be done. I mean, there are instruments for sure. Mental, physical, psychological, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you give some examples for our listeners? I know in the core it is love is the answer, but can you give some practical advice what people could do to say, well, what David is saying, that makes sense. How can we strengthen ourselves to all this manipulated information streams?
Well, you know, we are all different. So, of course, you know, not necessarily the same recipe work for everyone. But as I say, if you begin, forget about what's going on in the world because, you know, wars, epidemic, because you can't control them. Okay. You can't control them. Remember that anxiety, it's matched by our need to establish control. Internally and externally. But there are certain anxieties that are too large or too artificially created that go beyond our coping mechanism of control. So you need to go back to what you can control, what you can establish control on, right? Because a lot of the rest, doesn't matter what, you like it, don't like it, they're not gonna change it. Okay, mm-hmm. Right. And so everything begins with, you know, taking or establishing control in your immediate environment. And what is your immediate environment? Well, your mind, your body, your family, your house, your surroundings, your you know, your circle of friends. Okay. And if you already can establish a degree of harmony, okay, in this immediate environment, inner and outer, I would say that you are already in a good place. And how to do that? Well, again, there are many instruments out there. I mean, we live in an era of information for the good or for the worst. So, you know, you can find 1,000 different meditation courses, self-help, coaching, stretching, yoga, psychology. There is trillions of data out there, okay? Personally, I mean, of course, it's like, you know, I have, you know, through many years found what work or what I found interesting for me. So I can tell you, please, you know, come and try some of these practices that I thought there are, you know, online courses that people can buy, right? You don't want to do that? Start with, I tell you, 15 minutes a day, bring love at the center of your life, at the center of your meditation. Make it the center of your attention for 1, 2, 3 minutes at a time, because more than that is impossible. You start with 10 seconds, it's already amazing. Build up to a minute, build up to 2 minutes. If you can build up to 2 or 3 minutes at the time, you know, you are already a Buddha. You're already gonna be so much transformed and so much transformative for the people around you that you have done your duty, you have established that control, right? And control doesn't have a negative meaning here, okay? Control equal order, okay? It's entropy, okay, versus order. So yes, you have brought back order into an entropic chaotic environment, okay? And love is the highest order, okay? Mm-hmm. So you bring back that order, that means that control, you know, by practicing that, and it's not an intellectual thing, it's a feeling, it's an emotion, rediscover it. If you are religious, you can choose a short prayer and pray with your heart. If you are not religious, doesn't matter, find your way to bring about that. Few times per day, 1 minute at a time, try that. Just try that. Okay?
Very, very practical, very profound, deep insights, but brought in a very practical way. I thank you very much, David, for your time. I think any more questions will just disturb the clear thought that you brought into this podcast.
So, thank you very much. Thank you very much, René.
Yeah, and I will add the links to your website where people, if they are interested, can find your teachings. And
absolutely. Again, absolutely.
Thanks very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.